You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in store, on social media, and beyond. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in-line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/crimes, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/crimes to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/crimes.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow or find an awesome template. No judgment.
You're listening to an Ono Media podcast. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to Into the Dark podcast with Peyton Moreland. I'm your host, and I'm so happy you're here. Now, if you're watching this video and you're like, why is she wearing the exact same thing as she wore last week? That's because I'm actually recording a couple episodes back to back. If you haven't heard the news, my main show, Murder with My Husband, is actually going on a little spring tour for live shows. And because of it, I'm just trying to get ahead. So I swear, I didn't wash the shirt because it's actually the same day I wore it. I just want to say thank you guys so much for supporting this show. As you know, when I decided to start a solo show, it was literally one of the scariest things I ever did. I felt like there was all this pressure and I just wanted to make sure you guys would enjoy it. So it really means a lot. It means a lot to me when people not only listen to this show, but enjoy it, like support it. Really listen. So thank you guys so much. For my 10 seconds this episode, I was going to catch you up kind of on the last week we've had. We had some friends come into town. I've been working out 3 times a week in the morning with a friend of mine who is amazing, and that has been so hard but so good. I've been on a really big Caesar salad like rampage. I literally just want to eat Caesar salad, breakfast, lunch, dinner. Don't know what that's about, but I just can't get enough Caesar salad. I also restarted CSI, the original, so Vegas, from the beginning again. It's one of my favorites. I've watched it multiple times through, but I restarted it. And it's so fun to like learn, like watch a show develop into what it is. When you go back and watch the first episodes, you're like, what the crap is this? It's just not the same show. But fun fact about CSI, Grissom actually grew up in Idaho, where I grew up, and went to a college that was an hour away from my hometown and graduated from there. So I thought that was interesting when I was looking up all the characters. I was like, no way. So yeah, that's my 10 seconds. Just a fun little catch up. And let's get on to the episode. Now, this episode includes discussions of murder and self-harm, including suicide, so please listen with care. Now, there are always big questions on how it's possible to know anything. Sure, we can all read up on a topic, do our own research, but then you still have to wonder if your sources are any good. Maybe you think you understand a lot, but actually you're falling for misinformation. Plus, sometimes you can feel like you know something for sure without having any evidence to back it up. It's almost like your intuition is kicking in. You get a bad feeling right before something terrible happens, or when your phone rings and you know who it is without checking the caller ID. There's no way to explain where this insight comes from. You just know. This comes up in police investigations too. Sometimes detectives follow their guts to conclusions that they wouldn't arrive at if they were only looking at the clues. And sometimes that works out. A moment of inspiration and a lucky hunch can break a case wide open. But other times, their guesswork can lead to a disaster. So take the story of Marcus Golicki. On June 17th, 2012, his body was found near the shores of the Ohio River. The waterway was the boundary between Indiana and Kentucky, and Marcus was found on the Kentucky side. So the detectives who responded were from Kentucky's Evansville Police Department. They learned that Marcus was a 50-year-old unhoused man. He loved playing chess and had been studying the game for his entire life. He also just got out of prison less than 2 weeks before his death. Again, this was in 2012, where he was found in the river. This wasn't the first time that Marcus had been incarcerated. In fact, he had spent a lot of his adult years going in and out of jail. But during his most recent stint behind bars, he'd received a diagnosis that may have helped him make sense of his personal struggles. Marcus learned that he suffered from schizophrenia. It affected his mood, and he'd even been on suicide watch while he was incarcerated. So it may be no surprise that when the police called his brother to notify him of Marcus's body being found, the first question out of his mouth was whether Marcus had taken his own life. Especially because he was found in the Ohio River. There was a particular bridge over that waterway that Marcus often talked about killing himself there. He'd even walked out to the bridge on three separate occasions, threatening to end it all before other people intervened to save his life. So in the brother's opinion, it seemed very likely that Marcus had just gone through with it. I'm not sure how the police answered his question when he asked if Marcus had died by suicide, but I do know they had other theories based on the results from his autopsy. These were this. Those reports showed Marcus's neck was broken, plus he had a fractured rib. Marcus didn't have any other injuries, but the break in his neck was consistent with death by strangulation. So this made the police suspect that he may have been murdered, that he didn't jump off a bridge. They got their first lead shortly after they finished talking to Marcus's brother. A woman named Debbie Hurt called the station to say she knew where Marcus had spent his last night, so she was reporting it in the hopes that the information might help the investigation. Debbie said Marcus came over to her house, which was also a foster home where she had several teens staying with her. Now, as it turned out, Debbie and Marcus both went through the foster system when they were kids, and they'd lived in the same home for a while. So they weren't biologically related, but they were foster siblings. Marcus and Debbie actually were still close as adults, and that may have been why Marcus came over on the night of June 16th. Debbie said her 18-year-old adopted son, William Hurt, played chess with him until late into the night. She gave them both dinner, then went to bed before Marcus left her house. But William, her son, told her about the rest of the night later. He said that when Marcus headed out at around 11 p.m., William insisted on sending some food with him so he wouldn't go hungry. Remember, Marcus was unhoused. Apparently, Marcus also told William that he was going to walk through the night to get to a nearby town where he had some family. But as we know, he never made it to his destination. Now, William knew Marcus well and actually thought of him as kind of an uncle, and he had no history of violent crime. But since William was one of the last people to see Marcus alive, he voluntarily went to the police station so they could question him. And when he sat down with the detectives on June 28th, he didn't seem nervous, at least not at first. But then William began to describe the evening he spent playing chess with Marcus, and the police kept interrupting his story. They noted that some details were inconsistent. They asked if he'd just start his testimony over, only for certain beats to change the second, then the third, then the fourth time around. And the detectives told William his body language was suspicious too. He was making too much eye contact, like he was trying to act like he was innocent.
Because when you're remembering your bus ride, you're remembering all this stuff, man, you're looking to the right, which is drawn from memory. soon as you get to the back door, you're looking left with your eyes and everything else. You're lying. I mean, that's where you're starting to make up the story.
Each time the detectives told William they didn't believe him, he became more and more upset. He even burst into tears a few times. It was becoming clear to him that the police saw him as a potential suspect, but he insisted he'd never hurt his uncle. He had no reason to. And William also claimed he wasn't that kind of person. He didn't like violence and could never bring himself to harm someone in cold blood. But the police told him they knew he was lying. They could tell from the scrapes on his hands he looked like he'd been in a fight recently. Now, some reports say that William did have some scrapes on his hands at the time of this interrogation, but he said they were from his job. He scooped ice cream. The police didn't buy it, though. They warned William that they had evidence putting him at the scene of the crime. In fact, according to them, they'd already found his DNA on Marcus's body. And they'd pulled surveillance footage of William using Marcus's debit card shortly after his murder. Now, for the record, I just want to state at this point the detectives were lying. They hadn't actually found any DNA evidence or surveillance footage. They made up this claim about William using Marcus's card after he had died, just literally out of thin air. And because they had nothing, that was why it was so important for them to get a confession, because they didn't have enough proof without it. They literally had nothing. And I do want to note, this is all 100% legal. The police can basically say whatever they want in an interrogation. There are some states with restrictions around whether they can lie to minors, but William was 18 years old, so he was legally an adult. Either way, the idea is, if the detectives are dealing with a possible murderer or some other kind of violent criminal, they might need to play some head games to get them to cooperate. So they can pretend they have evidence they don't really have in order to coax a person to open up. But still, William tried to come up with an innocent explanation for maybe how his DNA had ended up on Marcus. Maybe he'd patted his uncle's back when he left the house or gave him a hug. He continued to insist he wasn't a murderer. He just happened to be the last person to see Marcus. But the detectives kept responding that they didn't believe him. Even though they didn't have much evidence, they were listening to their guts. So the interrogation dragged on, and it must have been exhausting for everyone. And I think you know where this is going. At one point, the detectives assured William that if he confessed and cooperated, prosecutors might go easier on him when he went to trial. But he kept insisting he's innocent. And they told him if he kept insisting he was innocent, he was going to go away for the rest of his life. He would never see his family again. Now, 18-year-old William was very close to his mother and his foster siblings. The thought of never seeing them again must have been terrifying, because he kind of began wavering at this point. All right, when you're traveling, do you ever stress about what's happening back home? Like, did you forget to lock up or leave a window open? That's why I totally suggest getting Simply Safe Home Security today. It's for top-notch security and peace of mind, no matter where your summer adventures take you. Anything you might worry about leaving your home for an extended period of time has been thought out by Simply Safe. It's whole home protection with sensors to detect break-ins, fires, floods, and more. It's definitely so nice, you know, when you're home, to be like, oh, no one's probably going to break in. But when you're away from home, it's also nice to have that peace of mind that there's not a fire, there's not a flood, no one is coming into your house. There's a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras we've installed, so we have a view of all the entry points. Plus, I just feel relieved knowing that it's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than a dollar a day. Simply Safe has given me and many of my listeners real peace of mind, and I want you to have it too. Right now, get 20% off any new Simply Safe system with Fast Protect monitoring at simplysafe.com/Payton, P-A-Y-T-O-N. There's no safe like Simply Safe. First, he said, okay, maybe he hurt Marcus on accident. William suggested he had a history of sleepwalking. Maybe something had happened after he went to bed that he didn't remember. Even William admitted he thought this was unlikely. But the detectives seemed so convinced of his guilt, maybe they'd be persuaded with this story. Except they weren't. More hours went by, and at this point, William had been in the interrogation room for over 3 hours. So finally, he burst into tears. He confessed to everything. He said he'd killed Marcus for his money. Specifically, he wanted to get his hands on Marcus's debit card and run up some charges on it. He hopped in a car with a few of his foster siblings, then found Marcus walking by the side of the road. They jumped out of the vehicle and beat Marcus until he fell down. Then William said he and his foster siblings choked Marcus to death. He even demonstrated it for one of the detectives, holding his hands against the interrogator's neck so they could see the exact way the teens had strangled Marcus. William actually put his hands in precisely the right way to leave the kind of damage the mortician had noted in Marcus's autopsy. So afterward, according to William, they tied Marcus up and threw his body into the Ohio River. Finally, he and his sisters and brother drove down to a nearby convenience store to buy snacks with Marcus's debit card. This was just what the police needed. Not only had William confessed, but he named his collaborators too. And his statement was enough for them to go after the other killers. So next, the police talked to William's 19-year-old foster sister. This was Deidre Hurt. They sat her down, and at first her interrogation went a lot like how William's had. She claimed she was innocent. She didn't know anything about how Marcus had died. But just like with William, the detectives told her they knew she was lying. That's when they revealed that William had already confessed. And once again, they insisted that Deidre's trial would go a lot easier if she just cooperated and told them what she knew. Still, Deidre insisted she knew nothing. She offered to take a lie detector test, but the police kept her in the interrogation room. They called her heartless and cruel. And the detectives warned Deidre that if she didn't cooperate, she actually might face the death penalty. Their exact words were she was, quote, going to hang. But still, Deidre didn't break. Not until the detectives began saying things that weren't true. Again, this time the police said that if Deidre didn't confess, they'd go after the rest of her family, basically implying that they'd arrest her innocent mother and siblings if she didn't work with them. Of course, there's no law that makes it okay to arrest someone because their relative lied in an interrogation. From what I can tell, it doesn't sound like the police ever actually wanted to go after Deidre's family. She didn't realize that. She started panicking. Finally, she said, okay, she'd killed Marcus with William and the others. But strangely, when she confessed, the details she gave did not match up with what William had said. The detectives figured she was still lying about some bits and pieces for some reason. So each time she said something contradictory, they encouraged her to just try again. And finally, Deidre gave a statement that matched up with what the detectives expected to hear. As soon as she finished describing the murder, they wrapped up the interrogation. Then they repeated the whole process again with another foster sibling, a 16-year-old girl named Andrea Hurt. Both William and Deidre had named her as another murderer. Police actually stormed into her house in the middle of the night and forced her to get out of bed. The police told her she was under arrest, and their interrogation began as soon as she got back to the station. But her session went a little bit differently. First, she wasn't totally alone the entire time. For the first portion of the questioning, her father sat with her and helped her navigate some of the trickier questions. She began the session by insisting she was innocent, just like William and Deidre had. And the police tried to use all the same tricks with her that they had with her siblings, but for whatever reason, she didn't break, not even when they tried to evoke Andrea's biological mother. See, her mom had passed away when she was just a little girl. The police suggested that her mother was looking down at her from heaven and feeling ashamed of her. The only way for Andrea to change her dead mother's feelings was to just come clean. But it didn't matter what the police offered her or threatened her with. She kept saying she knew nothing about Marcus's death. Finally, the investigators had no choice but to let her out of the interrogation room. But they weren't prepared to let her go entirely. She was already under arrest, so the police transported her to a local jail. About a week afterward, the detectives realized they didn't have very much hard evidence against Andrea. And even though Deidre and William had implicated her in their statements, she still hadn't confessed. So without a confession and without any physical evidence like DNA or fingerprints, they didn't have a very strong case against her at all. So the police dropped the charges against Andrea, and she went free after spending 1 week in jail. 4 months later, the same thing happened with her foster sister, Deidre. Even with her confession, the detectives weren't confident that their case against her was strong enough to take to trial. So she was released and the charges were dropped. By this point, William Hurt was the only suspect in Marcus's murder, who was still facing a possible conviction. And he went to his hearing in early 2013. When he took the stand, William insisted, okay, he didn't do it. This was in spite of the fact that he had told police he was one of the killers. William said he only confessed because the police essentially coerced his statement out of him. He was exhausted after being in the interrogation room for hours, and he was afraid. They kept telling him he'd get into terrible trouble if he didn't cooperate. So eventually, William just told them what they wanted to hear. But now he insisted nothing he said in his confession was real or honest. This was actually a major problem for the prosecutors, because without the confession, they didn't actually have any hard evidence against him. They knew that Marcus came over to William's house the night he died, and that was about it. In fact, without William and Deidre's statements, the prosecutors couldn't even prove that Marcus had been murdered. He may still have died by suicide, just like his brother-in-law had originally believed, like he had told people he would do at the Ohio River. And given Marcus's long history of mental illness and suicidal ideation, it wasn't that hard to believe he had taken his own life. All his injuries could have been self-inflicted, even the fractures in his neck and his ribs. So the trial really came down to one question. Did the jury believe William's confession was authentic? When they went into the deliberation, they asked the police to provide a recording of his interrogation. And when they watched the raw, unedited footage, it was jaw-dropping. Now remember that the police began the session by accusing William of contradicting himself. It was the first real sign that they didn't think he was being honest. And in fairness, William did change his story a few times. But according to the actual tapes, initially, it was only on minor points, like whether he was up until 10:30 or 11 the night Marcus came over. He also gave the wrong date when the police asked what day this was. Another time, William said that before he went to bed, he thought he heard his foster brother close his bedroom door. A little later, the police asked if he heard anything that night, and William said no. This all sounds like the sort of thing any normal person could forget or misremember, especially with time passing. When the jury heard the actual tapes, William wasn't telling some huge game-changing lie. He was just having a hard time with little details. And on top of that, the police fed him some information, and then they acted like it was a huge twist that William knew the things they had already told him. For example, early on in the interrogation, the detectives asked a bunch of questions, like, did he ever go down to the river? Had he ever left shoe prints by the river? And what would he do by the river if he was there? And then later on, William mentioned something about how Marcus had been found dead in the river, and the investigators interrupted. They asked William how he knew Marcus's body was there. Then they implied that a guilty person would know that, except of course, they already implied it pretty strongly. And it made the news when the police found Marcus's remains. William said he remembered the coverage. Like, this is his uncle, basically. How would he not know where the body was found? The same thing happened when William complained that the police were wrong to see him as a suspect. He announced that he knew they thought he'd killed Marcus. That's when one of the police officers replied, not one time have either one of us said anything about killing. Like this was some huge gotcha moment that William said it was murder, as though William couldn't just figure out what the interrogation was about based on the questions they were asking. Keep in mind, by this point, he'd been shut in a room with the detectives for close to an hour. At times, the detectives also threatened William with physical violence. They never actually raised a hand against him, but they warned that if William didn't start talking, he'd find himself in a lot of pain. However, the most shocking part of all of this, to me, were the parts of William's confession that were just flat out impossible. He said he killed Marcus and then used his debit card afterward, right? Because police initially used that lie, and then William goes on to say, yeah, you're right, that's why I did it. But the bank records showed that Marcus's card was last used 2 days before his alleged murder. So even if William had tried paying for snacks with the card, he would have been declined. Marcus only had 8 cents in his bank account. It should have been easy for the police to gather all of this information and realize William couldn't have stolen money that Marcus didn't have. And if he didn't kill Marcus for his card, he then had no motive, and the rest of the confession fell apart. Plus, there were other problems with the way William talked about dumping Marcus's body into the Ohio River. He pinpointed the specific area where he supposedly threw his uncle's remains in the water, but that spot was actually downstream from where Marcus's body was found, meaning his remains would have needed to float against the current for several miles before he was discovered the next day. Basically, William's confession was impossible. And it was clear from the recording of his interrogation that he was only telling the police what they wanted to hear because he was afraid, he was tired, he was confused. In fact, after he described Marcus's alleged murder, William asked the police, "Was I getting close to most of the facts of what actually happened?" Like, he didn't know, and he wanted confirmation that he had made up this story correctly. Later on, William asked again in the tapes, "Was I close to it?" The police didn't answer. But it wasn't too hard to see that William had been manipulated. Now, the sad truth is, coerced false confessions are more common than you might think. Like I said before, in the United States, there's no law that prevents the police from lying to adult suspects to get them to talk. And most states actually don't even have laws to protect minors from this either. Naturally, this can make some innocent people feel immense pressure to confess. You might wonder why someone would even do that. Why make a situation worse by taking credit for a crime you didn't commit? But some individuals can find it hard to resist the pressure when they're tired, hungry, and afraid. Add in that a police officer is claiming they have evidence on you. It's easy to crack under pressure, and I personally know someone who did a false confession and then was later exonerated by DNA. And there's a whole other facet to this issue, because when you add in minors or people with mental or emotional issues, it's even easier for false confessions to happen. The Innocence Project reports that nearly 1 in 3 of the wrongful convictions they've been able to overturn featured a false confession. So these untruthful statements and the tactics police used to secure them were and can be a huge problem. But at least in William Hurt's case, the jury realized his confession was false before they issued their verdict. It was enough for them to declare him not guilty of all of the charges, including robbery and Marcus's murder. Now, afterward, William, Deidre, and Andrea, and their foster mother, Debbie, sued virtually everyone associated with the investigation. This included the specific detectives who questioned the teens and the Evansville Police Department as a whole. The Hurts argued that the police had deprived William of his constitutional right to a fair trial. Their complaint said he should have never even been charged with the murder in the first place. By forcing him and his foster sister Deidre to give a confession, the police were essentially lying to the jurors, the judge, and everyone else who sat through a hearing that was entirely built around misinformation that police knew about. Again, that's according to the Hertz's lawsuit. They then also highlighted how traumatizing and terrifying it was for William and Deidre while they were incarcerated for months waiting for their day in court. Both of them spent some time on suicide watch, isolated from the other inmates. But when they were each released back into Gen Pop, they were intimidated and terrified for their own safety. Deidre specifically received threats from other women in her facility. They said that because she was a murderer, she deserved to die, and they'd bang on her bars when she was in her cell. For the 7 months he spent in jail, William was too depressed and scared to do anything but eat, sleep, and cry. Even Andrea's week behind bars was horrific. Things didn't get much better for her after her release. Her high school classmates bullied her, and she received death threats in the mail. Even though she never went to trial, almost everyone figured she too was guilty. She eventually had to give herself a makeover and use her middle name in the hopes people wouldn't realize who she really was. Now, clearly, the police were in the wrong to go after three teens, and on the surface, the lawsuit seemed like a slam dunk. They wrongfully questioned, arrested, and charged a trio of innocent young people. But it's possible to be wrong without violating the law. In fact, a lawyer named Mike Woods told a reporter that the case against the police would be hard to win. After all, there's no law against pressing charges against someone who's later found not guilty. That's the whole reason we have trials, because sometimes detectives do get things wrong. According to Woods, the only way the investigators could have been behaving illegally was if they actually knew for a fact that William and Deidre were innocent. And then they still coerced a confession out of them anyway. And even if that was the case, it would be hard for William and the others to prove it. They couldn't read the detectives' minds. But in spite of all of that, the Hurts negotiated for a settlement outside of court. They didn't publicly disclose how much the settlement was worth. In a press release, their lawyer said this was a major validation for the family. Not only was it further proof of their innocence, it would hopefully discourage the police department from ever coercing a confession from anyone else. But this wasn't a happy ending for anyone. Specifically, Marcus's sister-in-law, Mary, complained in the press. Even after everything, she still thought the Hurts were guilty because how could the police have been wrong? In her mind, William and the others had murdered Marcus and they then got away with it. She told reporters that now they were trying to make money off the crime, which goes to show, even though the Hurts thought the lawsuit proved their innocence, they'd never be able to convince everyone. Now, I do think it's worth noting that the Hurts believed that Marcus wasn't murdered. In their suit, they described him as dying of suicide, which is especially sad because he didn't have to die. And after he did, he more or less disappeared from his own story. In all of the discussion about false confessions and police coercion, the narrative became more about William Deidre and Andrea Hurt than about Marcus himself. Which, to be clear, William Deidre and Andrea were victims. They spent months in jail and lost their good names, all for a crime they most likely didn't commit. They received death threats from people who were convinced they were guilty. Their entire lives were knocked off course, and it seemed like they'd never be able to go back to normal again. Plus, to this day, some people, like Marcus's sister-in-law, still think they're murderers. All of them did their best to build new lives for themselves afterward. Deidre went to nursing school because she'd always dreamed of working with elderly patients. Andrea also went into a helping profession. In her case, she studied counseling because she wanted to work with young people. When she wasn't in her college classes, she was teaching Sunday school and volunteering at her church. And William spent a few years living at home with his foster mother. I only hope they all found some kind of peace after everything they went through. That's why when it comes to crime scene investigations, it's so important to set bias aside and follow the evidence. Hunches and gut instincts all sound good in theory, but they can be wrong. Even if you think someone is definitely a cold-blooded murderer, you can't always tell for sure. Cases like this are always a lose-lose. It never works out for anyone. All right, you guys, I will see you next time as we dive further into the dark. Goodbye.
You know that's the sound of another sale on your online Shopify store. But did you know Shopify powers selling in person too? That's right. Shopify is the sound of selling everywhere. Online, in store, on social media, and beyond. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/crimes, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/crimes to take your retail business to the next level today. Shopify.com/crimes.